Russian missiles struck the Black Sea city of Odessa, killing civilians.
In total, there are at least 21 casualties. According to the latest information, one of those is a boy aged 12.
Plus, what are the challenges facing Moscow as economic sanctions force Russia to default on its debt for the first time in more than a century?
Our sanctions are meaningful, but the Russians have gotten used to sanctions just as the Iranians have gotten used to sanctions.
And later in the program, how a Ukrainian poet passes the time while serving on the front line in the Donbas. Today is Friday, July 1st. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Russian missiles struck the Black Sea city of Odessa overnight, killing several. Reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv shares what is known about this latest attack on civilian targets.
There were attacks on two civilian, basically, objects. One is a nine-story building, residential building in Odessa, and another is a sanatorium. In total, there are at least 21 casualties, 21 people dead. And according to the latest information, one of those is a boy aged 12. It was an attack from the Black Sea, there were three missiles, X-22 missiles. This is what we have. We can see that the residential building, so one block of the residential building is completely destroyed, as well as there are a lot of damages of the hotel complex in Odessa region.
Anna, really quickly, in the time that we have left, do you have any updates about search and rescue efforts regarding the mall attack in Kremenchuk?
We know that as of today, rescue operation is going on. Unfortunately, it looks like more, even not bodies, but parts of the bodies are continue to be found. We know for the moment, again, that another six fragments of different bodies have been found. So for the moment, we know about 19 dead and at least 62 injured.
Anna Chernikova in Kyiv, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Leaders of this week's G7 and NATO summits renewed their support for Ukraine and promised to continue pressuring Russia to cease its hostilities. Russia also said on Thursday that it was pulling back from Zmeny Island, which is also known as Snake Island, as a goodwill gesture to show it wasn't hampering grain shipments. The British Defense Ministry's latest intelligence update, though, said that Russia's withdrawal was not the goodwill gesture that it had claimed. Rather, the intelligence update said that the area's isolation and increasing vulnerability to Ukrainian strikes drove the move. Russia's pullout came as Indonesia's president, Joko Widodo, visited both Kyiv and Moscow. And while there, standing in Moscow beside Russian President Vladimir Putin on Thursday, he announced that Putin would provide a security guarantee for food and fertilizer supplies from both Russia and Ukraine. Now, as Russia continues to face powerful economic sanctions, which has forced it to default for the first time in more than a century on its debt, what are some of the challenges facing Moscow on the world stage as it becomes more isolated? Texas Christian University political science professor Ralph Carter shared his thoughts with me.
Well, on the geopolitical stage, I think the Putin regime is in reasonably good shape, surprisingly. There are several developments there that would be a surprise to most of us in the United States. One is that the Russians have learned to live with sanctions, and the government there is doing what it needs to do to soften them as much as possible. So our sanctions are meaningful, and they will increasingly have an impact, such as the import restrictions on Western technology, grounding, you know, Airbus and Boeing-made aircraft for the airlines in Russia and that sort of thing. But the Russians have gotten used to sanctions just as the Iranians have gotten used to sanctions. Secondly, the elite that are closest to Putin are not the wealthiest oligarchs that we read about in the paper all the time. Those oligarchs who live outside the country, live in London and elsewhere, and have the big yachts and such, they don't have nearly the kind of influence with Putin as his inner circle, which are primarily security elites from the old KGB that he's known for all of his career. And those guys aren't fantastically rich, and they don't care about sanctions. They care about staying in power. So they're willing to do whatever they have to do to stay in power and to keep Putin in power, because that is how they stay in power.
You mentioned that the Russian population is learning or has learned to live with sanctions. And I wanted to get your thoughts on whether or not you think that the Russian population has learned to live with war, because by many assessments, this conflict is going to last for some time. And Russia has had to recently scrap the age cap on who can serve in its military and has just been forced to strategically withdraw from Snake Island in the Black Sea.
Well, I think the Russian public is not going to put up with this forever. There's already movements by the mothers of conscripted soldiers to demand that their sons come home. There's movements by the mothers of slain soldiers to stop the war. And while that is a minor inconvenience right now for the Kremlin, if the war continues on at a low level of grinding conflict in eastern Ukraine, as it looks like it will, over time, that will become even more meaningful. And that's the sort of thing that finally helped drive the Soviets out of Afghanistan. Yes, the West and the United States helped the Mujahideen defeat the Soviets, but a lot of that defeat was Soviet war weariness that started back at home.
TCU political science professor Ralph Carter. As NATO leaders met in Madrid this week, Ukraine demanded new heavy weapons to defeat Russia's invasion. So, what's been promised and what's been delivered? Henry Ridgewell takes it from here.
More than 450 Ukrainian troops completed training on new weapons in Britain this week, including multiple launch rocket systems, or MLRS. They are seen as crucial in countering Russian artillery. Captain James Oliphant is from the British Army.
Because it's a tracked vehicle, their rocket systems are wheeled. It's going to give them more mobility, which is going to aid in their survivability.
Britain and the United States have supplied several MLRS to Ukraine, alongside other heavy weapons, howitzers, armoured vehicles, drones, air defence and missile systems. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told NATO leaders he urgently needs more advanced weapons. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told NATO leaders he urgently needs more advanced weapons. He said, by providing them to us, you can completely break Russia's tactics to destroy cities and terrorize Ukrainian civilians. NATO itself is not supplying heavy weapons to Ukraine, explains Jim Townsend, former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for European and NATO policy.
That's not NATO itself as an institution providing things. It doesn't have them, but its allies do. And so NATO has been very supportive of allies providing that assistance if they can. There's an absorption rate and a training rate that has to be met as well in terms of timing. And that's what we're seeing play out.
Despite those constraints, several NATO members have made new pledges at the Madrid summit. U.S. President Joe Biden said an additional $800 million of military support was on its way to Ukraine, with over $7 billion pledged so far by the administration.
Including new advanced Western air defense systems for Ukraine, more artillery and ammunition, counter battery radars, additional ammunition for the HIMARS multiple launch rocket systems we've already given Ukraine, and more HIMARS coming from other countries as well.
Britain Thursday pledged an extra $1.3 billion in military aid, taking its total contribution to $2.8 billion. France said it plans to send six additional self-propelled Caesar long-range artillery systems, taking the total to 18. Ukraine is reported to have deployed these on the Black Sea coast close to Snake Island, which Russian forces abandoned Thursday. Germany has pledged to deliver 15 anti-aircraft tanks in July, while Spain is considering sending around 40 German-made Leopard tanks, though Berlin would have the final say. But as the war enters its fifth month, the West still has not supplied heavy weapons in the numbers that Ukraine says it needs. Fabrice Potier is a former NATO head of policy planning.
There is a political calculation that we should give a bit more, but not so much that somehow we can feed and trigger an escalation that gets out of control. And I understand the logic, but I think it's profoundly wrong because fundamentally that means we are asking Zelensky to fight with one hand in the back.
Ukraine says it needs a tenfold increase in the supply of weapons to counter Russia's arsenal of artillery. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News at the NATO summit in Madrid.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. During this week's NATO summit, the organization listed not only Russia, but also China as security concerns. So what challenges may that pose to the bloc moving forward? That's the question that I put to Jamie Shea, a former NATO official and associate fellow at the Chatham House Independent Think Tank, in part two of our conversation.
It does suggest that NATO has to now act in three circles all at once. Circle number one was the one that got most of the attention in Madrid, which was NATO going back to its core business of collective defense. The good news that the United States will put more troops and build a new army headquarters in Europe, as well as send ships and aircraft. Great to see America in the lead. And that certainly in Madrid encouraged lots of European countries to also pony up and announce new contributions for NATO's eastern flank. Circle number two is how to help Ukraine in the long run, but obviously keeping within realistic parameters. I think it was good in Madrid, despite all of this talk of Ukraine fatigue and, you know, European leaders giving up because of the impact of inflation and rising energy prices on their domestic populations. I think it was good in Madrid that everybody stayed together and reiterated the desire to help Ukraine and keep Ukraine fighting as long as it wants to fight. But of course, the United States has been paying the overwhelming amount of money of all of NATO to do this so far, you know, the $40 billion that Congress allocated recently. And I think the key thing for the United States with this group of 50 countries in the contact group all supplying weapons to Ukraine, the key thing for the United States is to get this on a sustainable long-run footing whereby the Americans pay less and the Europeans pay a lot more. It can't be essentially an American-led effort because I think Congress eventually, particularly after the midterm elections, might rebel. The third circle, of course, is to look at Russian and Chinese influence in the wider world, because these two countries are not just a threat to Europe coming through Ukraine, particularly, of course, given China's diplomatic support for Russia in Ukraine and blaming NATO as well. The Chinese are in Africa. They're trying to build more bases and ports. The Russians are in Africa trying to undermine what the Europeans are doing with their Wagner mercenaries. Their narrative that, you know, our model is better than the Western model goes down very well, with many countries refusing to implement sanctions and sitting on the fence. So it suggests that, you know, NATO, to paraphrase Lyndon Johnson, who said you have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time, NATO is going to have to be able to walk, run, and chew gum at the same time in terms of keeping its focus on those three particular domains. But if NATO wants to be a 21st century security alliance, that's the challenge it has to meet. It can't just do collective defense and just stay within its borders and look at the world, if you like, passively but suspiciously from beyond those borders. It's going to require engagement in Ukraine and working with those Indo-Pacific countries, Japan, New Zealand, Australia, South Korea, that turned up in Madrid at the summit, to see what they can do to link increasingly the common challenges in Asia to the common challenges in Europe. You know, the linkages are there, but we need to build more effective policy bridges between Indo-Pacific and Atlantic security.
Jamie, I want to circle back back to something you mentioned about perhaps in the future, NATO may need to look away and focus on more on things other than collective self-defense and perhaps have a presence in Ukraine. That's something that NATO and U.S. officials have said they want to avoid in order to avoid a direct confrontation with Russia. So are you saying that perhaps there may be a time in the future where NATO forces need to be in Ukraine?
I don't see that happening at the moment. Nobody in NATO, not the United States either, wants that to happen. But you mentioned that, you know, eventually things will come to a stalemate in Ukraine. And there will be a time when clearly nobody's going to win anything more on the battlefield. It doesn't make sense, like in Korea in the early 1950s, to keep the war running for 2 years with lots of new casualties for essentially to return to the status quo ante. And so NATO, of course, has to look at how it can help Ukraine when the time comes to secure the best possible peace. Ukraine will want security guarantees of a kind in order to accept that peace and try to deter a future Russian attack. NATO is also going to have to look at a long-term containment strategy vis-a-vis Russia, particularly to stop it rebuilding its army to gain superiority over NATO at a future date. I mentioned the challenges in Africa, in the Middle East, where China and Russia have been undermining the Western position. So I'm not suggesting a NATO military advance beyond its borders. NATO militarily will be a defensive alliance, but it's got to be more than just a military organization. It's got to increasingly throw its diplomatic muscle around with other partners, and it has lots of partners, to try to sort of build up a more effective collective security system against the authoritarians on the periphery of Europe and in the Indo-Pacific. President Macron once said NATO was brain dead. I think by that he meant that it was working very well militarily, but it wasn't playing much of a political role. And I think that's the challenge that NATO, to some degree, has to face up to going forward from Madrid.
Jamie Shea is currently in Brussels, Belgium. He's also a former NATO official and associate fellow at the Chatham House think tank in London. Jamie, thank you very much for your time today.
Anytime, Steve. You take care.
According to Ukraine's Ministry of Defense, female soldiers and officers make up about 15% of Ukrainian Army combat forces. Since 2014, more than 30,000 Ukrainian women have become combat veterans. Those numbers have increased greatly since the Russian invasion. Maria Prus brings us that story.
Slava Ukraini, Heroim Slava!
On day one of the war in Ukraine, Kyiv entrepreneur and junior lieutenant Yevgenia Emerald joined the Territorial Defense of Ukraine. A few days later, she became an officer of the Special Regiment of the Ukrainian Army.
I wanted to join the army back in 2014 when the military action in Ukraine started, but I had a small baby back then. This time when the war started, I did not hesitate. I can't imagine doing anything else right now.
Kirina Chernogus has been a combat medic with the armed forces of Ukraine for the past 2 years.
I joined the army partially because I've always wanted to do it. But I couldn't join in 2014 because I gave birth on April 14, 2014, right when it all started. In January 2020, it so happened that my boyfriend, who served in the army, died on site. So I decided to join in his memory.
According to Ukraine's Ministry of Defense, by late 2021, about 32,000 women belonged to Ukraine's armed forces. Katerina Primak is a co-founder of the Ukrainian Women Veteran Movement. For over 7 years, she has been fighting for women's rights in the armed forces. But she says despite all her efforts, women still often don't have equal rights with men in the army.
If a woman is serving in the army and she has a child and husband waiting for her at home, you can imagine what a more traditional society will say about such a woman, even though a woman has the right to choose any career, or both husband and wife can be in the military.
On top of that, women say they need to work twice as hard to earn the respect of their male colleagues.
I'll be honest, the first 2 weeks were very tough. But now I have proven myself with my hard work and persistence, and the guys accept me fully. And you know what? They are like family to me now.
In the 8 years since the first military action in the Donbas region in 2014, the number of women joining the ranks has risen considerably. And the Ukrainian women veteran movement has achieved considerable progress in reaching gender equality in the spheres of safety and defense.
Women are now seen as equals. They are being treated as people with rights. That's a very big step. No one ever talked about sexual violence or harassment in the military previously. And now this topic has ceased to be taboo. We're working with it.
For now, she says, the most pressing issues are having enough weapons and medications for both men and women. She is encouraging the country's Western allies to do what they can to help. Maria Prus, VOA News.
Pavla Vashiva joined the military on the first day of the Russian invasion, despite having no prior combat experience. Then, the well-known Ukrainian eco-activist headed straight to his native Donbas region. During brief calm moments on the front line, he wrote about what he was seeing and feeling. Anna Rice narrates this story to round us out.
You really have no idea what could be inside.
Let's open it. I don't know how to open it.
Pavla Vashibaba and his daughter haven't seen each other since the start of the war in Ukraine. The Ukrainian eco-activist joined the military when the Russians invaded. Now he has a few days to spend with family before he heads back.
I went to a store and asked for a large box, then popped by a florist and got some ribbons. Then I prepared everything and started waiting. I warned my wife so she wouldn't get scared, but for my daughter, it was a complete surprise.
Before the war, Vashibaba was an environmentalist and animal rights activist. After enlisting, he was sent to Donbas, where he was born and raised.
It's the best service imaginable, protecting your native land.
During the rare peaceful moments, Vashibaba writes poems, which have been shared and reshared on social networks. He dedicated one poem to his daughter.
Just don't write to me about the war. Tell me, is there a garden near you? Can you hear crickets and cicadas? Can you see little snails make their way up a vine? I think poetry can become a sort of bridge between the front lines and the home front. Many of my friends see it this way. They forward my poems to their wives to express how they feel, because often they lack the words.
Apart from composing lyric poems, Vashibaba records comedy clips about the war, like this one, about how to calm down relatives and friends.
When your wife, mom, or girlfriend calls, you must immediately throw on your sunglasses and fall back on the grass. Then you pick up and say, "It's great here. It's like a resort here."
After a few days at home, Vashibaba is heading back to the front lines. His goal is to survive and retain his humanity.
Of course, it's important to follow the latest developments, to know what's happening, to watch the news, to help the armed forces of Ukraine. But that doesn't mean we need to refuse everything that's human, everything that makes our everyday life, the simple joys of life.
Something to remember during troubled times. For Lesya Bakalets in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us this week. On behalf of everyone at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America, Washington, ba 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 zip. DC.